SQPN.com presents The Secrets of the Hobbit.
There and back again. A Hobbit's Tale by Bilbo Baggins. Now, where to begin?
Hello and welcome back to another episode of Secrets of the Hobbit. And we have a fresh episode, even though I am currently in Spain, in Madrid. By the wonders of time shifting, we were able to record another episode before I left. And that's the one that you're listening to right now. And one of the reasons that we did want to do an episode is that there was still a lot of news, smaller news and some a little bit major news that we wanted to cover that we couldn't get to in our last episode. So joining me today, as usual, is Dave Kale. Hey, Dave.
Hey, Father. How's amazing time travel technology is fascinating.
Isn't it amazing? And not only are we connected through time, but also, you know, you live on the other end of the planet. And yet we're doing this show about this common ground that we have that is literally the common ground of Middle Earth. And apparently Middle Earth needs elves. That seems to be the news of the day. There's another casting call for elves. Tell me all about it.
Well, we just discovered this, even though it was posted a week ago on Friday, August 12th, because we're doing this in the future, right?
Right.
Anyway, I'm speaking to you from the past on Friday, August 12th, and so I just now saw it. But basically, yeah, on trademe.co.nz, which I think is a New Zealand job website, The Hobbit just posted a casting call for elves. The company posting it is 3'7" Limited. It's located in Wellington. They said they're looking for slim men, 17 to 30 years old, and between 165 to 178 centimeters, or 5'5" to 5'8", and slim women, same age, roughly the same height, to play elf extras. So fascinating. Of course, this would be it'd be hopeless in the U.S. finding all these slim people.
You think? Don't you think that some fans might go on a crash diet in order to meet the required specifications? I think this could be a trend. You know,
it's true.
This could
Hobbit
be the ultimate motivator for people to lose weight. Is you can become an elf.
Hey, so how tall are you, Father?
I think I'm much more of a hobbit. I'm not very tall.
Because I was going to say, it. You know, amazingly, in the requirements that they put, it doesn't actually say you must live in New Zealand.
I'm 1 meter and 75 centimeters, so 175 centimeters tall. I don't know what that is in feet or foot inches, hobbit feet. I have no idea. But I'll just sit behind a microphone and report on what's going on in New Zealand. That's good enough for me. I'm a hobbit. I like to be home. But this could be another occasion for these rabbit fans. And we talked about this guy who wanted to be an orc. That's kind of a nice goal to have. To want to be an orc extra. We talked about him last week. He put up this website, but he's not the only person who is longing for a role, even if it's just a role as an extra in The Hobbit. There's another group of young people that created a website with exactly the same goal. They want to be extras in The Hobbit, and their website is called roadtotheshire.com. And just like the previous guy who wanted to become an orc, they too put a lot of effort in the creation of this website. It looks really lovely. And they would like to be hobbits, I think. At least they dress as hobbits in this great YouTube video that they made. It's kind of a spoof on the style of the Lord of the Rings movies, but it's starring them dressed up as hobbits, including the pointy ears, and it has a very fake-looking Gandalf who is encouraging them. So let's listen to this 2.5-minute-long YouTube clip that they created to support their cause and hopefully catch the attention of Peter Jackson himself.
In the lands of Middle-earth, legend tells the story of three hobbits led away by a blue wizard to a distant land in the Rocky Mountains on promises of pipeweed and delicious ale. Lost for decades, they've been trapped in the land of men, far west, where there is no pipeweed nor Rocky Mountain ale. Now, under the most unlikely circumstances, they have found the inspiration to get back home to the Shire for a great family reunion.
You only need $10,000 to get to New Zealand.
What must we do?
You must convince Peter Jackson.
We must raise $10,000 to ensure the safe travel of all three hobbits.
There are people here that do not sleep.
Come on, Elmo! We must unite the Tolkien fans. If we succeed, they succeed.
Horses are already moving. You can help Olo, Toad, and Benny get back to the Shire.
Come on, guys!
We can do it!
We cannot do this alone.
You have my tweet.
My YouTube subscription.
And my donations.
This task has been appointed to you. Only you can help them now.
And why should anybody help us?
Because secretly, everyone loves J.R.R. Tolkien.
Peter Jackson, you shall cast the hobbits!
You can make history by sending three hobbit fans on the journey of a lifetime. Leave your mark on one of the greatest epics ever told. Donate at roadtotheshire.com.
It's pretty well done. It even has these takeout scenes at the end. I thought it was a very, very creative way to catch people's attention, and it's actually, it looks very professional. It's a bit goofy.
I know, I'm impressed.
Probably on purpose, the goofiness.
Yeah, that's true. The cheese factor actually plays in their favor.
Yes. I like the way that they used, you know, you shall cast, and you have my tweets, and my whatever it was, my Facebook like. It's very funny to see how to which extent fans are excited about these movies and want to be in them. Now, do you give them a chance? Do you think this is going to work?
I have no idea. Did anyone try anything like this? I don't remember if anyone tried anything like this during the last film. I don't know.
We've seen fans working on a mockumentary, basically. It was a movie that was all about getting to Skywalker Ranch, like the holy grail for Star Wars fans. And the movie or the documentary would follow a couple of very avid Star Wars fans in their quest to get to meet George Lucas, and I think that actually got the approval of Lucasfilm, and they actually helped realizing that project, because they figured that, you know, it's going to get a lot of exposure, this is going to please the fans, and so it has enough traction for us to want to be involved. But I don't know about this initiative. There might be a lot of other people that would like to be in the movies, but not only do they have to find the money to travel to New Zealand, but then they also need to be fit in, and they, you know, the production needs to accommodate these kids and give them a moment where they can actually turn up as extra. So I don't know.
There must be union legal and union issues, I imagine. You know what I mean? I'm sure as part of the whatever deal they worked out last year, there's probably their ability to cast non-Kiwis in extras roles is probably pretty constrained. I bet.
I forgot about that. Yeah, there's been this whole. This was actually holding back the beginning of the actual production. All these negotiations. So you're right. Yeah. Well, anyway, I appreciate that these kids went this far, and I say kids, but I should. That sounds a bit unrespectful or disrespectful. I think these young hobbits have to be commended for the creative approach to this. And even if it's not going to work for them, and you know they might not be able to get into contact with Peter Jackson and might not be able to raise the money, it's still I think a gem in terms of production quality, and hopefully you know they'll put their talent to work in creating something that is Hobbit related. You know, if you can't get into the Hobbit movies, just make your own Hobbit movie. There's this whole fan fiction universe. It helped the whole franchise of Harry Potter quite a bit. You know, all the fan fiction that was out there, and actually, I think it even contributed to this idea of Pottermore, which is this kind of secretive project, this online world where people will be able to contribute to the stories. Who knows what this might become in a couple of years from now. Anyway,
very true.
That was great to see that. And
yeah, I'm excited, and I hope they did a there's an interview with them over at MiddleEarthNews.com, the Middle Earth Network news thing run by Arwen. There's a lengthy interview with them there, and I think they might be working on an actual interview with them on the radio station. But
nice.
We should have them on our show at some point.
Yeah, absolutely. Definitely.
Especially if they get there.
Then they will be our informants. The one of the actors that is certain to be in The Hobbit is, of course, Elijah Wood, and we talked about his return to New Zealand quite a bit. There's this article on Reuters that I don't know if we mentioned. I just can't remember, but I wanted to make sure that we talk about it just
in
case.
An older one, yeah. I don't think we got to it.
Okay. So this was an article that appeared on the last day of June, I think, in Hollywood Reporter. And it talks about Elijah Wood returning to film The Hobbit on the 10th anniversary of The Lord of the Rings. He says, "It's a rare opportunity to revisit a specific time in my life. It feels like I'm going back to a giant family reunion in a way. A lot of the same creative team are involved and a number of the cast are coming back." Let's see. Wood says that he won't be heading to New Zealand to film his scenes until the fall. I think we knew that because it needs to be springtime in the Shire. He says, "I read the first script and it's incredible. It definitely expounds upon the book. There are already characters that are cast that are not in the book, so that indicates that it goes slightly outside the boundaries in the structure of the original novel." Despite his long-standing relationship with his writer-director Jackson, Wood said he hasn't read their second script and has no idea how the big-screen adaptation of the J.R.R. Tolkien novels ends. So I suppose the second script, would that mean the script of the second movie or the second version of the script?
Yeah, I saw in the comments and some other places where they were discussing this article some confusion over that. Does he mean the second draft or does he mean the script for the second movie? I hadn't a clue. I'm thinking probably the script for the second movie.
Yeah, me too. I think so too. I guess this is just the first part, which would certainly match our theory that Frodo is basically going to be part of the very first part of the movie, where we see Frodo, we see Bilbo in the Shire as we know it from the time frame of the Lord of the Rings. Either before or after the events in Lord of the Rings, and then they will go back and show us, not young Frodo, because I don't think he was born yet, but we will see young Bilbo. So that might be a good way to help us make that transition from the Bilbo that we know to his younger self that we haven't met yet. And so I guess that indicates that he's not in the second movie. Which makes sense because it's, you know, there's no need. I don't think that we need to see Frodo at the end of the story because this is Bilbo's story. So
yeah, although, you know, if he is part of the frame story, perhaps we should see him at the end, you know, like little wrap-up scene where it's, you know, like if they're doing this sort of frame thing where it's Bilbo or Frodo or somebody reciting the story to somebody else, some audience or something, then you would think we'd kind of see them shots of them throughout the film, bringing it back to that frame story,
well,
voiceovers.
That's possible too. Yeah, that he will return you know, at various points. But Inge in the chat room makes a good point. She says, well, he explicitly says that he doesn't know how the story ends. So that could indicate that that he's talking about the script for the second movie.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, doesn't say anything because it might very well be that they were still tinkering with the second script and that he will get to see it later. Only Orlando Bloom has seen the whole thing, apparently. So he continues in the interview saying, "For a while I was excited just at the notion of going back and seeing everybody and playing the character again. Then sitting down and reading it, I became genuinely excited about the films they were making. I think they're going to be amazing." I think that we already mentioned that quote, but it's great to see how much, you know, he is Peter Jackson's, you know, main character. And so if Frodo thinks this is going to be great, then I feel that's a good indicator. that's
true.
A good sign. And he hasn't even visited the set. He hasn't been to Weta Studios yet. And we've heard from all the other actors that have actually already seen all the artwork and the costumes that blew them away as well. So it's going to be interesting since they're casting the elves right now. We know that one of the things that they're probably going to film is everything around Lake Town. But this seems to indicate that there's another big element, perhaps Rivendell, perhaps the Wood Elves. Who knows? Because there has been this other casting call for elves.
That is true. They're certainly not going to be in Lake Town.
We've seen in the first production video that the Rivendell set was built. It was there. Peter Jackson
right.
was walking in it. So to me, that makes me believe that what they have already filmed is Rivendell and the scenes there. And actually, there was this other photo, which I loved, where you see Bilbo and Elrond. And Bilbo, actually, the actor is on his knees just to kind of fake it that he's small. And it's it's the same technique that they used in The Lord of the Rings as well. And he's looking towards Elrond, and they're both standing on this, or kneeling on this balcony that definitely has the Rivendell styling, this kind of Art Deco ornamentation. And so I think it's very likely, since we know that they've been scouting, or there are these rumors about this river, you know, where they might film the escape on in the barrels, you know, that actually what they're going to film now is the whole wood elf part. And and I wonder if this is going to take place real out in the open in a real forest, or if it's going to be half studio set and half you know, real, because the part of Rivendell was shot in a park, right?
There's the scenes where they're obviously there's the scenes at the Fords of Bruinen where they're you know, fighting the Nazgul, and that's outside. And then there's the scene just as they're exiting Rivendell, when they form the company after the council, and they're leaving Rivendell to embark on the journey, that it's kind of an outdoor woodsy look. So so I imagine with the wood elves, there'll definitely be some outdoor, because a lot of that, when the dwarves first encounter them and they don't even really know what's going on, that's in Mirkwood. So that's going to be outdoorsy.
Yeah.
But then a lot of the wood elf scenes, when they're in the main, you know, sort of city or citadel of the wood elves, that's probably going to be indoors, I imagine, on a set, because it's most of it takes place in the Elven King's dungeons. So.
Mm-hmm. And it would be very expensive to build these houses and whatever, you know. Mm-hmm. It's usually very intricate architecture to put that out in the open, exposed to the weather. It's probably a risk that they won't take.
However, do keep in mind two things. One, that there will be other scenes with the wood elves beyond just that part, because the wood elf army marches out of Mirkwood to come battle. So we don't really see that in the book. We just hear that they're coming, but maybe they'll show it to us in the film. And keep in mind the other thing, that there's this additional storyline they're adding of the White Council's assault on Dol Guldur. Yeah. And I suspect that's going to involve elves. And I imagine that actually may be elves from Lothlorien, because it will be because Galadriel and Celeborn mm-hmm. will be involved.
Yes, and actually, we know that, that Galadriel is also. I mean, we've seen in the production video the costumes for those elves as well, and for Galadriel. So that is clearly something that's coming up. So you might be right. We might see those Lothlorien elves. Are there any? Do they look different? Are there any like distinct features of these Lothlorien elves?
You know, I don't. I mean, the way Tolkien describes them, at least in the Silmarillion, there's these sort of qualitative differences between the, you know, even not just between the wood elves, between the elves of Rivendell and the elves of Lothlorien, and then the elves of Lothlorien and the elves of Mirkwood. Actually, I think the elves of Lothlorien and Mirkwood are pretty similar. They're all sort of gray elves. Or dark elves, elves who did not ever travel over to the west.
Right.
That said, I don't think it's. I imagine Peter Jackson will attempt to do something to distinguish them visually, but we don't really ever get a sense of how they differ visually in the books. At least I never did when I read them.
And these big, if there is a fight scene or an assault, then it's pretty likely that at least part of that is filmed outside, just because of sheer, you know, you need a lot of space, just like they did with the, you know, the scenes in, you know, with the Rohan and everything. And a lot of that was just filmed out. And then actually also the battles in the third movie were filmed outside.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So, And then, of course, if it's really outside, then it's easy to spot and people will take photos, perhaps. Like
That's
there will
right.
be bystanders.
That is absolutely right.
Looking forward to the pictures already. So this is your chance. If you are not overweight and you live in New Zealand and you look like an elf, you can still make it. You can still do it. Now, of course, all this will really get the feel of the movies, not just but through the costumes and the characters, but you need the music. And we've heard this fantastic score by Howard Shore, who produced tons and tons of music, much more than was actually used in the final trilogy for The Lord of the Rings. And he is currently assigned for two more soundtracks for the Hobbit movies. And I couldn't imagine these movies with another kind of music. I mean, Howard Shore has created so many recognizable themes. And he recently was interviewed on Houston Public Radio because he was about to direct a very special orchestral performance of the music of The Lord of the Rings, where they project the movie in HD on a big screen. But the music, the whole soundtrack is performed live. And he was conducting, I'm not sure if he was conducting or just overseeing the project and someone else was directing. And we're talking about music that he wrote more than 10 years ago. And for him, that was a very special moment that to realize that there's still this huge interest for the score, but also I guess that there was another director, because he talks at one point in the interview about having a conversation about how to interpret certain passages. And he was just mesmerized by the fact that music was still being interpreted and that there were layers in there that hadn't come out yet. And so it's this living thing, and it's been a very important assignment for in his life. And towards the end of the interview, he also talks a little bit about this new upcoming project of composing the music of The Hobbit, and I wanted to play that last part of the interview just to have a reason to talk about the music. Let's see if I can get this to run. Playing it, of course, it played fine when it was preparing the show, and now it somehow doesn't want to play.
It's a trap.
Let me see. It is
about it.
There you
so
go.
I feel like it's very much a part of my life. I'm now starting to work on The Hobbit, and so I'm going to return to Middle-earth for the next 3 years. You know, the music has always been very much a part of me. I mean, this is a piece that's extremely important to me. It's really close to my heart. Tolkien's ideas about courage and friendship and honor, integrity. I mean, I love what he wrote about it, and it's very important to me. And to be able to return, and now I'm going back through some of my scores and reviewing things that I've done, and, you know, making now, I want to make connections between The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings, and so I'm going through that process right now. It's fun.
It truly is a gift that this production is out there and is available to audiences, and it's just a wonder.
Thank you.
Howard Shore, thank you so much for joining us on The Front Row.
Thanks so much, Brett. It's been fun talking to you.
It's very brief, but I still liked it because he talks not just about the visual aspect of the movies, but about the values that he admires in these stories, the courage, the friendship, the love, self-sacrifice. That's the stuff, I think, why these stories are so timeless, because this is the fabric of life. This is what we're all, you know, dealing with on a day-to-day basis, and mm-hmm. this is what carries the story.
Yeah. I think my personal feeling is that the music that Howard Shore did for the movies is some of my favorite parts of the film.
Yes. Well, and it was quite a feat to not only the quantity of music, but the way in which he constructed these very recognizable themes to color and to help the storyline. You've got that very charming music in the Shire that gives this sense of, you know, close to earth, close to nature. There's a lot of flutes in there, and they've got the percussive, almost like it's not music, it's just rhythm and noise when we see Saruman and the way he destroys nature. And it's such a polar musical opposite of what we heard in the Shire before. And mm-hmm. then just the epic scenes with the rousing themes, and it's the music itself talks about these values and it shines through. And in the interview, which I really recommend people listening to in its entirety, he also gives some details that I wasn't aware of. Most specifically, that he tried to use a lot of instruments from all over the world. He wanted to create a soundscape, like a musical landscape, that was as vast as Middle-earth itself and as varied as Middle-earth itself. And so he traveled, or he had people travel all over the world to find these exotic instruments and find people that could actually play them and perform with these instruments, which apparently was more difficult than finding the instruments themselves. And so he talks about instruments from India, from really Africa, the most remote places in the world where everyone makes music. Music is another, just like storytelling, it's just one of those universal cultural elements that you find everywhere and every time. And I just had no idea that there were so many exotic instruments. And the orchestra that he used, the composition of the orchestra, mimics the type of orchestra that the number of people that they would use in the 60s, strangely enough. So apparently that there's there has been an evolution in the composition of these movie orchestras, and he deliberately went back to the sound and the kind of the balance of an orchestra that these movies had in the 60s and the early days, you know, the glory days of movie making. And that too, because nowadays, oftentimes what they will do is they either just go completely overboard and they just do orchestras that are five times as big as what you would see normally in classical music. And it would or they will just use a couple of players and then add layers of digital music. You know, they can get very close to a symphonic sound just using computers. But he does it the old-fashioned way, and I can't wait to hear. Actually, I hope that we will get to see some production videos of the music as well. Even though he is apparently already going through the stuff that he wrote for The Lord of the Rings, and because of course he needs to make a musical bridge as well, and take some of the themes and evolve them. John Williams did exactly the same for Star Wars, where he went back to the stuff that he wrote for movies 4, 5, and 6, and then just took some of these themes and turned them around, twisted them, and to form the fabric for the three prequels, but to make sure that musically there are ties, there are common motives. And one of the brilliant things that he did was he took that Imperial March, you know, the thing that we tom 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 ta dum tom ta dum, and he that's in minor, and he turned it into a major key, and he used it for the theme of Anakin. So he took that very menacing military march, and recomposed it to make it sound very charming, very innocent, very beautiful, to symbolize the beginning. You know, this is Darth Vader originally was a good boy. And I think that Howard Shore is going to do a lot of similar stuff here with The Hobbit, because, of course, The Lord of the Rings, just as the Star Wars movies 4, 5, and 6, is the future, and we're going back in time. So you need to kind of devolve a little bit your musical themes.
That's an interesting proposal. I'm very excited to see what they do.
There and back again. A Hobbit's Tale by Bilbo Baggins. This is wonderful.
I meant to go back. Wander the paths of Mirkwood. Visit Lake Town. See the Lonely Mountain again. That age, it seems, has finally caught up with me.
Just like last time, we open up the first pages of The Hobbit, and we want to talk a little bit about the story, going chapter by chapter, and hopefully that will, get us excited about the story and perhaps give us some clues as to what will end up on the silver screen. Now, we said previously in this episode that the story is going to be expanded, and so the first chapter might not actually be the first thing that we see in the movie. There could be kind of an introduction, a historical introduction, like we saw in The Lord of the Rings, where we get a little bit of backstory. Perhaps we will see the Shire with old Bilbo and Frodo. But eventually we'll end up in Hobbiton and in Bag End. And we will see this first encounter between Bilbo Baggins, Mr. Bilbo Baggins, and the wizard that is going to put his life upside down, Gandalf. And that first exchange is kind of funny, isn't it? With the good morning. Good morning. What do you mean by good morning?
I love that. I mean, I think that's a very fun exchange, and it's an interesting sort of commentary on it's a fun little sort of language game, and it's an interesting commentary on the ambiguity of the English language, at least that Gandalf ultimately sort of teases Bilbo about using good morning to mean like 18 billion different things. You know, so they start off at the very first thing Bilbo says, good morning, and Gandalf is a little perplexed, and he says, what do you mean? He says, do you wish me a good morning, or mean that it is a good morning whether I want it or not, or that you feel good on this morning, or that it is a morning to be good on? And Bilbo says, all of them at once.
Yes. And a little bit further, he uses good morning to shoo away this annoying wizard. He's like, good morning, I'm done.
Yes,
another
right.
Use. Yep. And Tolkien, being this language freak, he must have chuckled when he was writing this. This is the power of language. You can use the same word for many different ways. And it all depends on the context and on the tone that you use and the actual intent of what you say. That will determine the final meaning of the word. And then, of course, Gandalf is not letting himself being chased away by this little hobbit, because he knows already that this is indeed a good morning for Bilbo, because it's the beginning of this incredible life change and this adventure. And perhaps Bilbo will have cursed this morning many times when he was struggling with his fate later on. But ultimately, I think and that's what you hear in the fragment in the jingle, in the opening jingle of this segment. He's grateful for these adventures, and it's now an integral part of his life, and he wouldn't have wanted to miss it for nothing in the world.
It is it's a fascinating sort of, it's kind of a prediction in a way. It hints at the sort of the future happenings later in the book. The fact that, you know, like, it really is a good morning, because this is the morning that will change Bilbo's life in a lot of ways. And then his attempt to shoo Gandalf away is that's sort of the Baggins in him trying to resist the change.
Yes. And it's interesting that the true meaning of that good morning only reveals itself at the end of the adventure, because that's when you when you can measure the weight and the importance of everything that happened after that one first morning. And in a way, that's almost a symbol of what happens in the total composition of The Hobbit, and this whole process, this creative process that Tolkien went through over the years. He wrote this first story, this first draft of The Hobbit, and I think it was called, the original manuscript was called the Priften Fragment. And then the second draft was called the Bladorthin typescript, because it featured Bladorthin, the wizard, and Gandalf was just a simple dwarf at the time, and he would be upgraded soon with more magical powers. But Tolkien has constantly revisited the story of The Hobbit in these chapters and has inserted lots of information, because he had developed this richness of Middle-earth and its mythology, and he needed to infuse these chapters with that knowledge to enrich them and actually prepare the reader for what was about to happen once that world started to take shape. And to me, that's always the most fascinating thing that happens in any creative process, be it writing a book or what Peter Jackson is doing right now in filming the book and making his own interpretation. It is all these added layers of meaning, and the story and the words can get a meaning that even transcends the original intent of the writer. I mean, these stories, now we are going to watch these movies next year and the year after that, and they are going to speak to a generation that wasn't even born when Tolkien wrote these stories. And yet, I am pretty sure that these movies are going to be huge hits, and they're going to speak to this generation in 2012 and 2013, and have a message for them that perhaps Tolkien might never have guessed. And actually, I think if you went back in time and would have asked Tolkien if he would agree to, you know, these movies being made about his books, he would probably have resisted this just as Bilbo resisted the adventure of, you know, these crazy dwarves at first. And yet, ultimately, in the end, it's going to benefit us, and it's going to benefit this new generation, because they get to learn about this wonderful mirror world, almost, that shows us these values of friendship and courage and self-sacrifice and all that good stuff. I think it's going to be important for the next generation. These are values that transcend this particular story. And in a way, I think Tolkien has set in motion something that, you know, he couldn't contain, and that's amazing. I mean, we've got we talked about the music, how much this composer was touched by this story. I don't think that Tolkien ever thought that there would be this whole symphony that was written around the stories and was inspired by these chapters, and yet, look at what happened. We treasure that music. I listen to that music all the time, even without really, you know, thinking back of the story. But the music has gotten a power by itself, and I think that this is what's going to happen time and again. And Peter Jackson is going to add his own layers of meaning to the story. And so, in a way, it's very reminiscent of performing music, where you take the original notes. It's actually what Howard Shore said in this interview when he spoke with this director that is going to direct his music in a live performance, and that director was adding his own interpretation to the music that he wrote. And that must be such a fascinating thing to witness, to sit there and to hear a version of your music that you yourself hadn't come up with. And so, I don't know. I'm looking forward to eternity, where we will all sit together and, you know, I hope to speak to Tolkien and watch the movies with him and see what he thinks, you know, if he still thinks it was a bad idea or not.
Perhaps we can get a commentary track from him complaining about everything.
Wouldn't that be funny? Or we could have like a heavenly version of The Hobbit, no longer restrictions of time and actors and negotiations about labor rights and everything. We could make the most awesome remake of The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings.
That's true. It could be exactly for each. It could be different for each viewer watching it and peering in his mind exactly as he wanted it to be.
This could be, by the way, an interesting discussion later on in the history of this podcast. When you know, I would love to grow the audience for this podcast, but also grow the interaction with our listeners and ask them what these movies mean to them and how it impacts their life. Because for a lot of the fans, it's not just a story. It's something that sometimes really changed their lives, and it changed their view or their value system. I don't know. I'd love to hear stories like that. Oh well, that's for later on when we are out of topics and when the movie is done and in post production and there's no more news leaking out.
So, what do you, Father? What do you think? What do you make of the dwarf song?
The song at the end, I actually really like it. I hope that they're going to sing at least part of that song because it gives us kind of a musical narrative of their story. And I don't have it in front of me, unfortunately, because it's on my iPad, so I don't remember exactly the contents. But doesn't Bilbo kind of... murmur wait a second, I think he overhears one of the dwarves that is sleeping and is still singing that song. It is it's a poem that
he kind of Bilbo's sort of drifting in and out of waking consciousness, and he starts to hear fragments of the song kind of coming into his mind as he's falling asleep and waking up and stuff, and it is sort of very poem-like.
Bilbo is enchanted by the song, isn't it?
That's sort of the power of the song. It's this song describing sort of fantastic vistas and adventures in faraway lands and ancient history of the dwarves and the fantastic treasures that they created, and then what happened when the dragon came and attacked and took it all away from them. And it's sort of their, it's almost like their, it's like their battle song, as it were. It's the song that they're singing that gets them revved up to go on their journey, and it has the same effect on Bilbo, especially because earlier the dwarves were disparaging him and saying like, this guy doesn't look like he's, going to be too good a thief. He doesn't look like he knows what he's doing. And Bilbo listens to the song and he starts feeling like, oh man, this really appeals to the Took side of him. The Baggins side of him is saying like, this, you don't want to go on this journey. It's going to be dangerous. It's going to be quite uncomfortable. But when he hears this song, a flame sort of, burns brightly inside of him, fanned by the Took side of him, saying like, well, maybe I do want to go on adventure. And it sounds really wonderful.
I'm reading I've got the Blatterthin typescript here in front of me. And I think the song is slightly, the poem is slightly longer in the earlier versions. But what I love is what's written here, is what it does to Bilbo and how actually I think the song awakens in him the burglar. I'll try to explain what I mean. The reaction of Bilbo to the song is, as they sang, the hobbit felt the love of beautiful things made by hands and by cunning and by magic moving through him, a fierce and jealous love, the desire of the hearts of dwarves. And then something Tookish woke up inside him, and he wished to go and see the great mountains and hear the pine trees and the waterfalls and explore the caves and wear a sword instead of a walking stick. He looks out of the window. The stars were out in a dark sky above the trees. He thought of the jewels of the dwarves shining in dark caves. And then he sees this flame and he thinks of the dragon. And, I think the assessment of the dwarves at first when they see Bilbo, that he is going to be a lousy burglar, is actually a correct assessment. Because Bilbo, in order to be a good burglar, you need to desire what is not yours. You need to have this... this want of something that you want to risk your life and your own security to go and steal it because you don't have it. But when we first meet Bilbo, he doesn't have any desires. He already has everything. He has the most beautiful house of Hobbiton. He has all his meals, his reserves of food and drinks. He has everything he needs. And he thrives on this regular life where every day brings the same good stuff. And so it's only by listening to the desire of the dwarves that he hears in the song, and perhaps that's why Gandalf actually wants them to sing and wants them to take out the instruments, because he knows that this music has the power, almost a magical power, to awaken this desire for something that goes beyond this very simple life that Bilbo enjoyed so much. And you need that desire to step away from your old life. And that what is called the Tookish side is actually, I think, almost a metaphor of our desire of something that transcends us. And I think we touched upon this last time as well. I think that Tolkien, being a Catholic writer, is very much aware that ultimately our ultimate goal in life is not the food and our entertainment. It's not our job. It's not the money that we make. But ultimately, our desire and our longing is for something that is beyond this world. Like the Grey Havens are like a symbol of, you know, that it's where you go when you depart from this world and go to this other world that is much more, you know, it's much more fantastic than anything that you can experience in Middle Earth. And so right here at the beginning of The Hobbit, we hear about this longing that is so important to the story. And if you see the journey that Bilbo undertakes, again, as a kind of a symbol of the journey of life and the evolution of this hobbit in terms of he starts to grow, even though he's already, what is he, 50 years old? His real growth begins at when he's called to this adventure. And when this longing for something more is awakened, and then that makes him a good thief. Because he knows that towards the end of the story, he knows exactly what he needs to steal. And it's not just the treasure. He knows that there's something else that he needs to get. And, well, you know, he gets that, what is it again, the Arkenstone. And that ultimately is bringing this whole reconciliation. And it's as if the whole journey teaches him what is truly important, and it's not just having your pipe weed and having your second breakfast.
Yeah, I love his reaction to it, that the song sort of has this power, and song in Tolkien always does, although usually we attribute it to elvish song, having the ability to create in your mind things that aren't there. But in this case, these dwarvish songs have the same impact on Bilbo, it conjures up in him sort of it inspires in him almost dwarvish feelings, love of beautiful things, and fierce and jealous love, the desire of the hearts of the dwarves, which is fascinating. But I also love the fact that, you know, he starts getting riled up, and then he starts imagining plundering dragons, and then he suddenly feels scared and becomes Mr. Baggins again very quickly. The song wasn't quite enough.
Well, he's at the beginning of his journey. What I love is that he starts to see the world from a different angle, or he starts to see meaning and a depth that he wasn't aware of earlier. He looks at the stars and he sees gems. He sees precious stones. And he sees a fire in the distance, and it's probably, you know, just a farmer or whatever, a little fire that someone makes to whatever grill a rabbit. Instead of seeing just that fire, he sees the breath of a dragon. And so he starts to become aware that the universe and Middle Earth is so much bigger than he thought it was. And he starts to become very sensitive to, you know, this extra dimension that he wants to experience, and that is the energy that he needs to get going. So, it's full of meaning. Actually, the more I think about this first chapter, the more I love it. It's kind of just reading through the History of the Hobbit books. It's striking that some of this stuff has remained the same from the very first draft till the version that we now know. Whereas more trivial parts, so this longing and the song, it was there right from the get-go. And a lot of the trivial things are modified and changed time and again, especially the names. Tolkien spent days and days thinking about the names of his characters, and he would just sit down and write down all these names. We've seen the Gandalf changing from a dwarf into a wizard. For Bilbo, he wrote down names like looking that. He had like all these different versions of what ultimately became Bilbo. And then Tolkien is a smart guy because he just recycled all those names and used them for other characters, whether it was in the Hobbit, or he would use it in The Lord of the Rings or in The Silmarillion. So a lot of the stuff was used afterwards. But gosh, now I can't find the reference. But a lot of the names were very similar to Bilbo and Bobo and Dobin and whatnot. He would just continue writing till he got a good feel that this was the name that he needed.
He was the man. That is something that Tolkien is particularly good at. He's not shy about revising and writing and making tons of versions.
And then I think he drew upon a lot of the his knowledge of ancient mythology and literature to find inspiration for all those names and areas. And gosh, I don't know if there's like an encyclopedia of all these names, but it's quite amazing how many different terms and names he had to come up with to make this world believable. It's almost a literary version of what Weta Studios is doing right now with all the sets and the dresses, the clothes, the armor. There is much more detail than we will ever see end up in the movies, but they just need that fabric to make it believable. And the more detail you put into it, you know, the more we will believe that this is a world that truly exists. And even in The Hobbit, Tolkien plays with that. He's like, well, hobbits, they were or they are. It's like we don't see them that much because they've grown shy of us, you know, grown up or what is it, big people. But they might still be around. Again, you never know. The world might be, there might be more to this world than just what we see. I want to wrap this episode up with a few small tidbits that some leftovers.
What's happening out there?
Shall I describe it to you? Or would you like me to find you a box?
Well, the dwarf introduces us to the smaller news and tidbits. I've got a story here in the show notes that says that Saoirse Ronan, who was the main character in The Lovely Bones, she's very disappointed to miss The Hobbit. She wants to pursue a career in Hollywood, and apparently that was not easy to combine with this this role that she was cast for. Or I don't know, they were in talks with her to play an elf. And I guess that she's starting to realize that might not have been a very good decision to step away from The Hobbit. I personally think it's very stupid to do that, because with The Hobbits, you enter movie history and you will no longer be forgotten. Whereas Hollywood, you know, gosh, there are so many movies and TV shows that come and go and nobody remembers them even a year later. So anyway, what's this thing about the SGO's Mystica for The Hobbit? What is that? Park Road Post relies on Mystica?
I put that one in there
you,
a long
you
time
added
ago
that
I'm
story.
Pulling it back
okay.
up. I'm trying to remember what it was. Where did it? Now I can't even find it. Where is it? Okay,
oh,
there it is.
Oh, it's good. About 3D. I thought this is kind of
yes. I thought this was kind of an interesting post. What it was is it's like an industry post. It's like it's like news for people who work in film production. And I thought it was very interesting because they were talking about The fact that that Miska had been chosen to do stereo and DI work, which I think is I think it's actually for the sound. For the doing the this like you know creating the sound of not the sound effects but you know how the 3D surround sound is done. That was the impression I got.
Okay,
maybe let me check and make sure. No, high frame rate. Okay, so it's the video. It's not the sound. It's the 3D video.
Yeah, they use stereo here, not for sound, but for the stereo.
Yes.
The whole calculation of the stereo image, and of course that
stereoscopic.
Needs to be...
Yeah, there we go. So yeah. So anyway, so I thought this was a very interesting sort of very
techie post.
Yeah, this is really getting into the weeds of the details of the shooting of the Hobbit. So in that industry, that's huge news that Mystica gets to work on the Hobbit. I mean, that's got to be huge for their company.
I guess so. They are currently hosting 6 4K workstations. That means like 6 supercomputers, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And 4K means that's the definition of the image quality. So you've got like 4K means that you've got like full high resolution. Actually, this is much higher resolution than what we'll end up seeing on Blu-ray. So they're filming in like super high definition, and they use the same resolution for all the colors. So you have red, green, and blue, which basically can make any color. And usually in kind of lower budget, high definition production, they would just give one of those colors the entire resolution, and then they will just use a lower resolution for the two other colors. And the reason is that the detail comes usually from just one color, and it will reduce the actual amount of data for each frame. But of course, with all this, you know, this computer industry is evolving so quickly that now they can handle and process just full resolution on all three colors. And of course, we're talking not just about one frame, but for every frame, you've got a second frame, which is filmed to get the stereo view. And so all that, you know, we're talking so much data. It makes the early experiments that George Lucas did with the Phantom Menace look like an amateur 8mm film project, because that was in its infancy. He was the first director to really use digital cameras, and I think they were just filming in 1080, whereas Peter Jackson is filming in it's just really unfathomable the amounts of data that they're gonna be able to process. So it doesn't surprise me that they need these very specialized companies to help them process all that data. And then you have to add to that all the, you know, the special effects, and all that has to be rendered in super high resolution as well. So wow.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Let's see some more tidbits. Let's see.
There's the David Stratton cruise. There's this. I'm trying to find a good. We'll post a link to it or something.
Oh yeah.
But
yeah.
There's this going to be this fun cruise departing Sydney on January 17th, returning January 31st. That's sort of a cruise plus film festival.
Mm.
And I think part of it is going to be visiting. One part of it is they're going to visit Hobbit and movie sets.
Wonderful.
For Lord of the Rings and Hobbit and stuff.
Wonderful. I'd so like to go on a cruise like that. And then, of course, we had Stephen Colbert. We talked about this whole political use of the term Hobbit. And then Stephen Colbert, who is a huge Tolkien fan, he used that as an excuse to show off his awesome Tolkien memorabilia collection. And let me play a little bit of that video.
Drags on and on, and frankly, both parties have been acting like children, with the Republicans saying, gimme, 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 and the Democrats saying, take it, take it, take it, just don't hit me. It is causing trouble for both parties. Yesterday, John McCain attacked the Tea Party for their naivete.
The idea seems to be that if the House GOP refuses to raise the debt ceiling, A default crisis or gradual government shutdown will ensue.
And this is still about the whole discussion where he uses the term hobbit. And then, of course, Stephen Colbert is like, well, you guys know nothing about hobbits. I know a little bit about it because he shows a statuette of Saruman.
He lights up. Is that not awesome? Okay. Now, you see, Saruman is in league. He's in league with Sauron back here.
A huge statue of Sauron.
He's in league with Sauron, who is actually Obama. Okay, and the hobbits, the hobbits aren't the Tea Party. The hobbits are Cantor and Boehner, okay? And let's say Lieberman just on appearances. And Gandalf
another
is
statue
the Tea
of
Party
Gandalf
right here, okay? You shall not pass legislation raising the debt ceiling. And then the cave troll. Ah.
He's got a huge cave troll.
The cave troll is, I don't know, but it's awesome. let's say Nancy Pelosi. I don't know.
And then the big surprise. I also have a pinball machine
over there. It's a Lord of the Rings pinball machine. It's a limited edition, and that is the American people. And the American people are really fun. Oh, one more thing. And this of course, is Aragorn's sword and Duril, Flame of the West, reforged from the shards of Narsil, given to me by Viggo Mortensen. Now, this has nothing to do with the metaphor. I just want to remind everyone that I have this.
It's totally brilliant. And wow, it's a huge short sword that he shows off, and it looks fantastic. he's lucky to be such a famous host, so he gets all these goodies from people like Viggo Mortensen.
It is pretty lucky.
I wanted to play that at the end of our show. Thanks for listening. Check us out on our Facebook page or on thehobbit.sqpn.com. We'll be back next week. Until then, may the hair on your toes never fall out.
SQPN, leading the way in Catholic new media.